Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. I am so glad that you've tuned in to our local food focus show this week because we are revisiting a few terrific interviews from earlier this year. And the reason for that is simple and comes down to three words: Mac and cheese. In January, we talked with promoter RJ Wall about his sold-out Mac and Cheese Fest in Indianapolis. And this week, he announced that his super popular Return of the Mac Fest will make a second appearance in Bloomington next month. So with tickets on sale now for two sessions of the Bloomington Mac and Cheese Fest, it seemed like the perfect time to revisit our most recent interview. And we also get to hear from an up-and-coming young voice in local food when we talk again with Kara Gunthorpe of Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana. Kara has joined forces with her rock star farmer dad, Greg Gunthorpe, to help run the family business of pasture-raised pork and poultry, and we caught up with her while she was driving the delivery truck in Indy, making weekly deliveries to local restaurants. Also this week, we talk with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey and hear why and how he and co-founder David McIntyre decided to launch a distillery in Indianapolis and focus on whiskey. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Indianapolis is getting lots of attention these days for its dining scene, which includes the pop-up dinners presented by RJ Wall of Chef's Night Off. We've talked with RJ several times here on Eat Drink Indie Radio about the dinners he's put on featuring up-and-coming local chefs. He's even taken his Chef's Night Off dinners to other cities recently. But he's also branching out with different food events, bigger food events, including this weekend's Return of the Mac, a macaroni and cheese fest that he and partners MOKB Presents and Do317 are putting on in downtown Indy. I talked with RJ this week about how the idea for a macaroni and cheese festival came about, how it outgrew its original location, and what he's got in mind for future events. So we are talking today with RJ Wall of Chef's Night Off.
Hello.
and you bring all sorts of interesting food-related events to Indianapolis. You've done a lot of chef dinners. You've taken chefs to other cities, even to the James Beard House to cook. But this week we're talking about macaroni and cheese. So tell me about the Return of the Mac, your macaroni and cheese fest.
What does everybody love?
Well, I like macaroni and cheese.
Mac and cheese, tacos, pizza.
Right.
These are things that everyone loves and enjoys. And Chef's Night Off had been going its own direction for quite a while, and I'm very happy with the direction it went.
Absolutely. Fine dining direction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, upper scale, thoughtful, farm to fork food. And I wanted to do something that was all-encompassing for everyone, for Hoosiers. I do a lot of work in the heavy metal world and the music world, and I was like, what can I do that will be interesting to everyone? So I called my partner, Josh Baker, at MOKB Presents and Do317, and I get this idea. And we had talked about it for probably 9 or 10 months before.
Oh, really? Doing some other sort of food event?
We had discussed several different food events. They do a lot of awesome concerts, and they do the Food Truck Friday.
Absolutely.
The Mario Kart. And I couldn't have thought of anybody better to partner with on it. And we kicked around the idea of mac and cheese for quite a while. And finally, we met a couple times and it was like, we're pulling the trigger and we're going to do it. And I asked a couple chefs. I think Brad Fraser, Bryce Bison, Josh Huffman at Sangrita, and Kuma's were the first three I asked. And
right.
They're like, yeah, this sounds like a great idea for 600 people.
Right. But so... The idea took off. I mean, it grew in a big way. I mean, like, exponentially. So tell me about what happened when you said, hey, I'm going to do a mac and cheese fest.
First off, thank you for all the chefs who agreed to octuple the amount of output of food. We put it on sale with just pre-sale code to our personal mailing list,
sure.
Chef Side Off and MLKB's. And there was 100 tickets left by the time it went on sale to the public. So we doubled occupancy. That sold out in about 8 minutes.
Right. So after you sold out the first round, you thought, well, you know, there's more interest. We'll do a second
session.
Round, a second
yeah.
session.
And that sold out truly in 8 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
We couldn't keep up with the social media for it. We knew it was going to be great, but we didn't know it was going to be that just.
Well, now, what happened? Why did it blow up so much, do you think?
It's macaroni and cheese.
It's
just, it's hard to, it's just that simple. For $22 or $23 or whatever it is to come in and try macaroni and cheese from 23 restaurants, or it.
Okay, there's the appeal right there, right?
Yeah, that's it. It's just a simple formula.
Right.
I keep trying to explain it to everyone, and they're like, but what? And I was like, that's it.
It's just macaroni and cheese. Although when you say just macaroni and cheese, I mean, that macaroni and cheese is pretty darn good. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
Even basic macaroni and cheese is pretty good.
I mean, I'm still a Kraft box mac and cheese guy. I probably will have some for lunch today. But then, you know, Leighton Roberts mac and cheese is going to have black truffles and Gunthorpe hot dogs, and it's going to blow some minds.
And so we're talking chefs from top restaurants in mm-hmm. Indianapolis, like Jose Vida, like Leighton Vida, and various other restaurants.
James Beard,
yes.
You know, had not Alan Sternberg, and down to, and I don't want to say down to,
including,
I mean, we just put Nada on yesterday. I'd love Nada.
So a Southwest inspired mac and cheese.
Then we've got Rooster's Kitchen.
I'm sure that will have bacon in it.
Oh, I'm 100% positive it's going to have bacon in it, and you know, Kuma's will be a part of it. There's so many different places. The spectrum is going to be just absolutely wild. We've got a couple catering companies that jumped on board that I think are going to be a lot of fun to deal with. Monon Food Company, who I think has an awesome array of mac and cheese on
right.
their menu.
Okay, so now after you added you did the first one, it sold out. You did the second seating, it sold out. You had to move the event, though. Tell me about that.
There was a lot of things that factored into that. I had spoke with my friends who are food writers in other cities and asked them what they didn't like about food events in their town.
Uh-huh.
I had heard everybody's gripes about Indianapolis food
sure.
events. I wanted to see what other ones were. I wrote them all down on a piece of paper and said, I'm not going to do any of these things. The space that we were originally at was kind of cold.
Right.
We were going to have to do a lot to dress it up and make it a great event.
Now, you had originally thought it would be in the Circle City Industrial Complex.
Yes, and it's a great place.
Oh, it's a wonderful, lots of space. It's where the Indy Winter Farmers Market is,
absolutely.
For example.
And you know, Larry is awesome to work with. It just outgrew. It outgrew
yeah.
the space.
So once you saw how big it was going to be, where did you look next?
We immediately looked to the Pan Am Pavilion. I don't think that we entertained any other spaces. The infrastructure there is amazing. For the event that we're doing,
sure.
They have a great staff, so it's going to be pretty push play going in there. I mean,
now what were some of the other concerns that you were trying to address in addition to not being a kind of too chilly?
Parking's a big thing. There's plenty of parking at CCIC. Being too chilly, sinks, bathrooms.
Oh, right.
Atmosphere.
Infrastructure.
Just those things. CCIC or Pan Am Pavilion has a lot of that already in place. So our guests out the gates are going to have just a much more pleasant experience.
So you just have to bring the mac and cheese, right?
Yes, which is for 500 or 600 people, that's not a logistical nightmare.
Right. Now, tell me how many you're expecting now.
3,000.
3,000 tickets sold for your Mac and Cheese Fest.
And
for Return of the Mac, which takes place this coming Sunday afternoon. So how did you grow from your 600 thought, you know, original thought, to the 3,000?
There were hours and hours and hours of back and forth dialogues. And we have a Josh Baker, I've worked with his camp. You know, I open
sure.
up Hi-Fi with all of them, so we all have a good
right.
relationship. And this gentleman, Tad, who works on Josh's camp, is the guy that's well, how's this going to work? How's this going to work? And he forces you to, I just pull the trigger, go and make it work. Tad like eliminated all my roadblocks before I got to him because he, well, this might not work this way. So it takes a team, and mm-hmm. we spent a lot of time on making sure that the food was going to be warm, not overcooked, not undercooked.
Well, no one wants to eat cold mac and cheese correct. At their mac and cheese fest.
So, you know, that and in conjunction with making sure the Board of Health is happy,
another big concern.
It is. It is. And I think a lot of times at food events, people try and skirt them or hide things from them. And I have just been super transparent with Kelly. And I'm like, this is what we're doing. You don't like this idea? Cool. We'll do this.
Right.
And ultimately, I think that's going outside of cooking on site. This is going to lead to the best product possible.
Okay, so people will have made their macaroni and cheese all the restaurants, mm-hmm. and they will bring it here
yes.
to the venue.
It'll be warmed up in catering style warmers.
Right. So it's a walk around tasting event.
Yep.
So describe what people are going to experience a little bit.
So they're going to come in, and we have, because it's 18 degrees today. This is another thing. So at Pan Am Pavilion, everybody will be staged inside while they wait to get their wristbands and turn their tickets in.
Oh, so they won't be lined up outdoors shivering waiting to get their mac
and
cheese.
They will not. That was a big point of contention for me, was I wanted to make certain that did not happen. So they'll be kind of inside, I hate to use the term corral, but they'll be corral area, and then they'll get their wristbands, they'll walk in, and they will just walk in a circle around. And I don't care if they walk zigzag back and forth.
So there'll be food stations all around.
Food stations all over. Similar to the way Diggins set up in nature.
Right.
Just
so people can walk around. Now, will they have to go in a little line, or can they go here and there?
They can go wherever they want.
Stop in at their favorite restaurants.
They can stop in at their favorite. They can go. They can stay at their favorite. They can do. We're not putting any rules on them. We just want them to eat and be happy.
So now what does their ticket get them?
Their ticket gets them just the sampling of the 20-something mac and cheeses. It's, if anybody eats a sample from all the places, I will.
Oh, it's nap time then. They have to go
home. It will be.
They won't go home and go to sleep.
I mean, that's 40 ounces of mac and cheese or something. That's a lot of macaroni and cheese.
Now, I do know people who make it a point of pride to try every station at Dig In, for example. So
yes.
you're going to have people that want to try every mac and cheese.
I believe they will. And we've set it up so that every chef will have enough food to do that.
Oh, now see, that's a very important thing. You know, so does everybody actually get to try all of the mac and cheese?
They should, yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
And unless something just bad, like a car accident or
right.
dropping, or everybody should be able to try everything.
Now, are there still sessions for people coming in? Different times for
the VIP ticket was $35, and that gets you in an hour earlier. And we kept it a very limited number of tickets, so the max amount of people that's going to be in line at a station would be two or three
mm-hmm.
when you go, which. Two or three people in line would quantify to 30 seconds.
Right. Oh, sure.
And then they'll have seated high top tables in a VIP area and their own private bar. And then there are three other bars. We want to make sure that people were able to get drinks and water
mm-hmm.
and whatever else as well, not just
right.
one bar where it all bottlenecked.
Right.
That's me. The thing I don't like about events is I don't like waiting 20 minutes to get a beer.
Right. Right. So what kinds of refreshments are available?
So we'll have a full bar, just standard full bar. Tito's Vodka is one of our sponsors, so there'll be a lot of awesome cocktails from Tito's. And then Founders is our beer sponsor. So, I mean, Founders doesn't make a bad beer. So
there'll be a cash bar available, right?
Absolutely. There will be Oberweis milk available as well. We just got them on board yesterday.
So this is a family-friendly event.
Absolutely. We're going to have Ryan Hickey, DJ Helicon, who's put together the Orange Fest, and then Ryan Strobel will be DJing, but it will be DJing family-friendly music.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking kids' songs, but...
No, but you know, appropriate to bring the kids to the Mac and Cheese
Absolutely.
Fest.
And kids 6 and under can come in for free. I've found over the last 3 years, 4 years of doing events, that the kids stuff, though I don't have kids, we have a really young population of people with kids that still want to go out and have fun.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I feel like that was an isolated group of people for a long time. Unless you went to a pizza place with crayons, there was nothing for you to do.
Right. Which is nice because, you know, events like Dig In have drawn a lot of people with families.
Absolutely.
A lot of kids to those sorts of tasting events. So it's not just for the grown-ups.
No. And I think it's also, I mean, kids, first off, love mac and cheese, but even when I do
it
my...
It is a natural.
I mean, it's a fit. But when I do my vegan dinners, I can't tell. There would be 25 kids there, of kids eating green stuff and red stuff and orange stuff. And, I you know, we want kids to grow up eating good food and not just go to...
Not just go to the fast food chains that we might run across all the time. So what other information do people need to know about Return of the Mac? Now, do tell me about the name. So it's Return of the Mac, but you haven't been here before.
I haven't been here before. I was going to reference an Ice Cube song. Mark Morrison, Return of the Mac. We were kicking around different ideas, and we loved it. We just Return of the Macaroni and Cheese, Return.
Right. So it's a fun, lighthearted reference, you know. So it's not like, oh, you missed the first Mac.
No, not at all. And to be frank with you, Josh Baker and I have both out the gates wanted to keep this very fun and lighthearted.
Right.
I try and keep Chef's Night off that way as well.
Sure.
Sometimes it naturally goes a different direction. But anybody who knows me or ever works with me, I'm pretty. I don't take things too seriously.
So this is a fun event, although it is sold out. Absolutely,
yeah.
Right?
It's absolutely sold out. If you missed this one, we're looking at Hamilton County and Bloomington right now. I think Bloomington will happen first.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I still can't believe it's sold out that fast. It was, and we've got some great sponsors too: the Indiana Dairy Association, Founders, Central Restaurant Product, Tito's Vodka, Story Inn.
So you're going to be doing this again?
Absolutely, we're going to do it bigger and more fun. I want Mark Morrison to perform next year. I think that we've got a ton of ideas.
So we'll see the Return of the Mac return.
Yes, absolutely. I'm certain that we will do it again.
We've been talking with RJ Wall of Chef's Night Off about the Return of the Mac, Indy's first macaroni and cheese festival. For more information, go to chefsnightoff.us or look for it on Facebook. Greg Gunthorpe and Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana have become well known to the local food community and to high-profile restaurants in Indianapolis and Chicago for their pasture-raised pork and poultry. And Greg Gunthorpe has been a voice for small farmers and processors. But another Gunthorpe has recently stepped into the local food limelight as well. 22-year-old Kara Gunthorpe has joined the family business in sales and marketing and is also becoming involved in the local food community. This past week, I got the chance to ride along in the delivery truck as orders from Gunthorpe Farms were delivered to local restaurants. Driving that truck was Kara Gunthorpe, and in between deliveries, she talked about joining the family business and becoming a local food and farming advocate. First of all, we are on the Gunthorpe Farms delivery truck making your deliveries in Indianapolis. Now, tell me what a regular delivery day is like.
So we leave the farm at 5:30 in the morning. Yeah, and normally our first stop is Trine University in Angola. Then we head to Fort Wayne, hit some cool places like the Golden, 800 Degrees, all those places. Seven Sons in Roanoke, and then we head to Indy, make it to Indy around 11 or so, and then we spend the day everywhere from Mass Ave to, we go as far south as Greenwood, and then up here, like here we're at Goose the Market, and then we'll head to Broad Ripple, then Zionsville, and then Carmel, and then we head home. So we're lucky to make it home by like 7, 8 o'clock. That's at the earliest.
Oh my goodness, so that is a very long, very busy day.
Yeah, it's really long. So I do all the driving, so it took me a long time to be able to be confident enough to drive the truck, but I do.
Well, now tell me a little bit about yourself and when you started working with your dad, Greg Gunthorpe, who people are very, he's very well known in the local food community for the Gunthorpe Farms up near LaGrange.
So, I joke that I've been working at Gunthorpe Farms for 22 years now.
Because that's how old you are, right?
Dad never expected us to come back to the farm. It was never, oh yeah, you need to be a part of this. It was like, you are going to help while you live under my roof, and if you want to come back afterwards, like, the opportunity's here. So, I went to Purdue, I studied ag business, food marketing, and started out in management and realized real fast that I'm not made to manage people, but Dad kind of hinted, hey, maybe you can work with our customers, and then I was like, light bulb, and I hurried up and got my degree done in 3 years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so graduated in May and have been working full-time in sales and marketing here for the farm since then.
Now, what do you do in addition to, of course, making the deliveries and interacting with your customers?
So, in addition to making the deliveries, I joke, really, I'm a truck driver because I make the deliveries, I drive stuff to cold storage, you know, I have all sorts of fun driving this truck around, but I also, you know, contact all of our customers, so I take all of the orders, I reach out to them, I send out newsletters, I keep all of our social media sites updated and our Facebook or our website, whatnot, and then really I just do a little bit of everything here and there. So
now you plan to stay with the company and help continue to grow the business?
Yes, I definitely plan on staying with Gunthorpe Farms. I don't see myself going anywhere. So I'm actually in the process of buying a house less than a mile from the farm, so that'll help me stay in the area, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, where are we off to now?
Now we are headed to Cafe Patichou's production kitchen.
All right, well, here we go. Has it been challenging driving the delivery truck through Indianapolis traffic?
Well, I was really nervous because, you know, I'm from middle of nowhere, northeast Indiana. So traffic for me is when there's a tractor in the middle of the road. But so I was nervous about driving in Indy to begin with, let alone this big box truck. But Dad needed the help, so I slowly just started. He always told me, he's like, well, you know, once you're graduated, you're going to take over the Indy route. And I told him, there's no way that I could ever do that. And slowly but surely, I just found myself behind the wheel. And yeah, I've only ever hit one exhaust fan. So I've done good.
So now what is it like when you make a delivery and you're interacting with your customers?
It's really cool because I've been doing this since May now. And so, like, they all know me. And what I think is really cool, especially, so there's some of the groups, like Cunningham Restaurant Group, the guys, like, move around. They don't stick at one restaurant for too long. But, like, so I can see them, like, Casey at Livery now started at Vita. So, like, I knew him when he was there. So it's just kind of cool to see where everybody goes. Like, the local food movement is such a small network. Like, you kind of, once you get in, it's like you know everybody. And, like, Ricky from Peterson's moved to Charblue. Like, it's just connections all over the place. And, like, I feel like these people are actually my friends. I don't know. So maybe they wouldn't say the same thing. But, like, I know who's having kids and what they're doing in their lives. And I don't know. It's really, really relationship-based. So I think it's pretty cool.
Well, then tell me a little bit about your work in the local food community and how you're becoming more and more involved.
That's been really fun. So, originally, people are like, oh, we're trying to get a hold of your dad. And Dad would be like, well, I can't make it. Can I send my daughter, Kara? So, I'd be like, well, yeah, sure, I'll go. So, I'll fill in for you. Well, now I actually get invites to be involved in these sort of things. So,
What sort of things you made?
So, like, right now, I'm actually on the Northeast Indiana Local Food Network board. So, we're establishing somewhat like a Indiana-grown program for Northeast Indiana to give Northeast Indiana its own brand. I was featured in Family Farmed in their Growing Young Farmers program. Just all sorts of cool little things where people actually, yeah, we want you because you're a young voice, like not your dad. And I'm like, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Now, is that what you had in mind all along, is to become a voice in the food community?
Yeah, kind of. I've always looked up to my dad, and he's always been this sort of figure in the movement. So it's always been in the back of my mind, like, my dad can help so many people. Like, how many people are wanting to do what my dad does, but they just need that extra push, or they need someone fighting for them, or someone to show them the way, even, or give them advice. So I figure the more of these groups that I can be a part of, or the more events I can speak at, or the more people I can reach out to, the more farmers we can have, which is the ultimate goal.
Well, now tell me a little bit about Gunthorpe Farms and the philosophy that drives that.
So at Gunthorpe Farms, we raise pigs, chickens, ducks, and turkeys, all on pasture without the use of antibiotics. We have a USDA-inspected meat processing plant on the farm, so we do all of our own slaughter. And then we do full fabrication, so everything from whole carcasses down to portioned pork chops, chicken breasts, and then we even do ground products and smoked meats as well. So basically whatever customized meat cut you need, we can get it to you. And then we do all of our own deliveries as well. So
so it is a very big operation for a small family-owned company.
Yeah, it's really big. We're up to around 250 acres here and there. It's always changing a little. But with that, we have 20 full-time employees and around 10 part-time employees. So just on our 230 acres, we're able to support 20 full-time employees, plus, you know, myself included, my brother included, my mom, my dad, my sister. And then all the part-time employees, like, the local food movement is like rural development at its finest.
We've been talking with Kara Gunthorpe of Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana. Stay with us for more from Kara here on Eat, Drink, and Do Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, and Do Radio talking with Kara Gunthorpe of Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana. Gunthorpe Farms has become well known for its pasture-raised pork and poultry, and the farm supplies restaurants throughout Indiana as well as Chicago. Making the deliveries to many of those restaurants is 22-year-old Kara Gunthorpe, who has grown up working on the farm with her dad, Greg. Now Kara has joined the family business handling sales and marketing, and is becoming active in the local food community as well. I rode along with Kara as she made deliveries this past week, and we talked about where the business is going, what it's like being a young person in agriculture, and how she hopes to help other small farmers.
So where do you see it going? Do you feel like the future is bright for what you're doing and what you and your dad are trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I would definitely say that there's so much room to grow. Like, especially now, right now, Gunthorpe Farms is at a really cool spot because me and my brother is 20. He is managing the processing plant on his own full time. And then, you know, I just graduated from college. So we're bringing new ideas and able to help my dad. Whereas before, you know, dad kind of got it as big as he could get it on his own. You can only do so much with one person. So, like, Gunthorpe Farms personally has a lot of room for growth now that we're bringing in more management. And then, but, like, the local food movement is just crazy right now. But one thing that might be hindering it, I would say, is the whole greenwashing of the local food industry.
Well, now talk a little bit about that.
Greenwashing is what I would say the only thing that could stop the progress of this movement, because everyone says, oh, well, I'm already buying antibiotic-free chicken. Why would I need to buy pasture-raised chicken on top of that? So once you get this one label claim, antibiotic free or whatever the case might be, or, you know, the organic label or whatever, people are like, oh, I'm already doing this amazing thing, so why would I need to buy Gunthorpe's that are actually outside on pasture? I'm already buying antibiotic free. I don't need that. So that's something that's really frustrating, because how do you differentiate yourself? Like, you can sit there and tell them all that you want, but when it comes down to it and you're looking at the bottom dollar, and, you know, restaurants are very price conscious anyways, they think they're already doing this amazing thing. So it's really hard to just, no, you're not doing enough. You need to do more.
Do you feel like there is enough momentum in the local food movement, that sort of the idea of local food, to sort of keep driving it forward?
I really hope so. I think so. It's just overcoming that, the incremental change. Like, because there's something like, oh, we should make all chicken antibiotic-free by 2024, or some ridiculous goal. And it's like, well, that's people are already doing that. You're just making it harder for the people who are already doing all of these extra things because they have to compete with this incremental change. So, I really think, though, that there's enough players that are actually involved for the right reasons instead of just, you know, following that money trail, that, you know, there's enough farmers and there's enough purchasers that actually care, that hopefully we can keep the consumers educated that, you know, incremental change isn't good enough.
Now, what about as a young person in the local food community and in the agriculture industry in general? What's been your reaction to that?
To the incremental change?
Or? To being a part of that industry.
I mean, this is kind of all that I've ever known. Like, I'm really lucky because, you know, my dad was selling pigs to the live market, to the commodity market in 1998. For less than his grandfather did in the Great Depression, he was selling them for 5 cents a pound, if he was lucky.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, it was ridiculous. But, like, I was 4 years old at the time. I don't remember that. So,
So this is, your situation is really all you've known. This, you've grown up seeing the animals raised like this.
Yeah. And my family's done this. I'm the fifth generation to have pigs on pasture. So, like, this is literally all I've ever known. Like, pigs in a barn, what? Okay. So, and like when I was growing up, I really had no clue that it was even
unusual.
Like I finally got, I think it was in high school that I finally realized that, oh my gosh, wait, we're really weird. I was in FFA and some kids are like, well, you're like one of those hippie farmers. And I was like, what do you even mean? I don't even know what you mean by that. And like, they ended up getting kind of snotty with me. And I was like, wait, this is not, oh, okay, I'm different. I get that now. But, like, it's really all I've ever known. And I know, like, I've always had this appreciation for where food comes from. And, like, restaurants are always excited to buy from us. They like to tell people that we're where they get their meat from. Which, if you're buying other stuff, it's not like you smack that on your menu. So it's just, I've always had this appreciation for it. And I kind of took it for granted, I guess.
So now, as you think about it, you know, what is it like being well-known in the restaurant community, not just in Indiana or Indianapolis, but in Chicago as well?
I mean, it's kind of crazy to think about because, like I said, I'm from the middle of nowhere, Indiana, and the fact that you can go to all of these upscale restaurants and see our name everywhere, like, we're getting pictures all the time from friends and family are like, oh, look, you're on the menu again. Look, it's your name again. Oh, cool. So, I don't know. It's a really cool feeling.
Does that ever get old, you know, just seeing Gunthorpe Farms, you know, in connection with some of the brightest stars in the food biz?
I mean, it's definitely, I wouldn't say it gets old at all. It's pretty cool, though. Especially, like, Rick Bayless has done so much for us, and we're actually sending out a load of chorizo to his new place in Florida this week. They had got some stuff, some smoked turkey thighs for a Thanksgiving special, and they just were like, oh, let's throw some chorizo on that, too. Well, then this week they emailed us and were like, hey, we need some more of that chorizo, like, now. So we're like, okay, so we're going to be sending some more stuff to Florida here soon.
So being a young woman in agriculture, has it ever been challenging?
Yeah, a little bit. Being a young woman truck driver is kind of challenging at times. I don't know. I feel like I go back and forth between really appreciating the fact that I'm a woman because it makes it easier and really hating the fact that I'm a woman. I don't know. I feel like sometimes I don't get taken seriously or they think I'm too young, too this, that, or the other thing. But people are more likely to help me when I need it, so that's really nice.
So do you like the business? Do you like the work, the deliveries, the working with customers and restaurants and chefs and that sort of thing?
I do. I really, really like it. And, you know, sometimes working, I get into little tussles with my family or whatever, but at the end of the day, I'm like, stop bickering, because I just really love my job. Like, at the end of the day, I'm excited about what I do. I see lots of opportunities to change things and kind of work with it and make it my own. Like, yes, I work for the farm, but it's almost like I'm kind of my own entrepreneur. Like, So I get to have new ideas all the time, and like I'm definitely an extrovert, so making deliveries and talking to people and, you know, going and speaking at events and being a part of like the local food network and like just getting to talk and have ideas is really exciting to me. And hopefully, you know, I can help be a voice that helps create more farmers, because ultimately that's the goal. Like, when my dad was my age, there were 600,000 pig farmers in the United States, and now there's like 60,000. 90% of pig farms disappeared in one generation. So, you know, obviously something's got to give. You know, we want to make our food here in the United States, and I want to be a help. Like, I want to be a part of that. So the more farmers we can have, the better. And the more consumers that we have that care about where their food's coming from, the easier it is for farmers. Because, you know, selling pigs to the commodity market doesn't work for everybody. And so, like, advocating for more small processors. Like, we had that meeting at the farm back in October. So we had, like, big shots from the USDA out to talk about what struggles that very small processing plants face. Because there's a lot of struggles. Like, we're not asking for easier rules or lax legislation or anything like that. We just want USDA to play fair and allow small farm or small processing plants to work in a way that is feasible for them, because we don't have 10 people that we can stick on QA and dealing with our HACCP plan at all times. We have, you know, my brother, who also has to manage all of our employees, and like, we just can't have someone sit there and deal with USDA all the time. So, like, things like that, like, very small processing plants have a lot of challenges that they face, and if I can help reform that to allow more small processors, maybe there could be more small farmers, because processing is a huge bottleneck in the industry. So, like, the more advocacy work, the more rural development I can be a part of, like, it's just, I want there to be more farmers, and I want more consumers to realize that there should be more farmers. So, I don't know. I think that my job at Gunthorpe Farms is put me in a good position to also help my, like, my advocacy work.
We've been talking with Kara Gunthorpe of Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana. For more information about the farm, go to gunthorpefarms.com. Now we turn our attention to the drink part of Eat, Drink, Indie. There has been so much development on the local craft beverage scene with beer, wine, even hard soda, but also in spirits. The number of distilleries in Indiana has grown tremendously in recent years, and we're only going to see more. But how do you get started? We hear a lot about craft beer and about those who hone their skills as home brewers, but that's not an option when it comes to hard liquor. You just can't practice making whiskey in the basement. So how do you decide to start learning and then open a distillery? That's what I wanted to know when I talked recently with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey in Indianapolis.
West Fork Whiskey was founded by three guys from a small town in Bedford, Indiana. We got our name because we wanted to pay homage somehow to Indianapolis and the state of Indiana. And the West Fork of the White River flows through Indianapolis. And so that was kind of how we got our name, and we always joked about starting and running a business together between us. So kicked around the idea for a little while. We all got passionate about whiskey independently, and lo and behold, David McIntyre, one of our partners, calls me one day and says, "Blake, I filed our articles of incorporation." And so not long after that, we cashed out our 401ks, funded the company, and started making whiskey.
Now, when was that? Tell me the time frame.
So that would have been early 2014. We applied for our license. No, that would have been mid to late 2014, I'm sorry. And then we applied for our license, did all the business due diligence, business planning, all that stuff. And in early 2015, applied for our license, mid-2015, started production in December of 2015.
So it's been a year that you started production.
That's right. We just had our first year anniversary last week, and that corresponded with our bourbon release.
So tell me a little bit about the products. You know, what you have, what just came out, and maybe what's in the works.
Absolutely. So we only do whiskey. We don't do gin, vodka, or any other spirit. And with that, our first product was Tour Delay, which is unaged corn whiskey. It's very sweet, butterscotchy. It'll finish very warm and sweet. Our second product, about the time we were putting some more money into the company, and was an aged corn whiskey. We named it Double Down because it kind of translated into, hey, we started making whiskey at a smaller scale, and now it's time to really put some money into the company and scale it up a little bit. We proved this concept, proved we can make a decent product. Now it's time to do it for real. And so that's Double Down. Our second product, which is a corn whiskey aged in used bourbon barrels. And our third product, which we're really proud of, is our first bourbon. It's a weeded bourbon, and we released it. It's called The Colonel. We released it last week.
Background, you know, so you're 27. You are in business. How do you come to be involved in a distillery? I mean, how do you come to say in your 20s, I'm going to start a distillery?
Well, we got a little kick, again, from my partner. We'd always joked about starting a business, and we love whiskey. And we love the state of Indiana, and we always thought it was a shame that so much of Indiana's corn, or a significant amount of Indiana corn, went to Kentucky and Tennessee to make their bourbons and Tennessee whiskeys. It kind of upset us, and as I noted, we're all passionate. All three of us are passionate about whiskey, and so we said, hey, we think we can do this. Our skill sets lend well to the spirit between the three of us, and Indiana's makes some of the best corn, and corn makes great whiskey, and we have some of the best water with the limestone aquifers here in the state. So really the fundamentals were there to start a whiskey company. And so we said, you know what? Let's throw some money in the pot and start making some whiskey.
Now, you said you're all real fans of whiskey. Now, tell me about your background.
Yeah, so my dad's an amateur collector. We've tried everything from single malts to bourbons, Canadian whiskeys, Tennessee whiskeys, whole gambit. And so we just started drinking the spirit a lot before it became popular. And then over the last few years, it's obviously gone through a huge boom. And so we just love it. And we decided, hey, if we're going to start a business and we're going to take the risk and take the time and do something, we've got to be really passionate about what we're doing. And we're passionate about really two things. That's Indiana and that's whiskey. And so we've really tried to combine those two things in West Fork Whiskey Company.
Now, where's it located? And what are your plans as far as trying to get your product out in front of people?
So today we're located in Traders Point area. We're not open to the public. Unfortunately, the laws have changed where we have a three-year waiting period. But we're moving in May to 17th and Bellefontaine, which is across the street from Cannonball Brewing. There's a lot of development going on in the 16th and the Monon area between the new apartment complexes and Tinker Street's investment in the area and Cannonball Brewing. There's going to be a cafe close to us, a restaurant catty corner. So it'll be a nice little cool hub. Right there, close to 16th and the Monon, and so we're going to move there in May or June. With that, we'll come brand experiences of some type. So we'll open up to tours and educational experiences and things of that nature to allow people to start interacting with the brand. Although we won't legally be allowed to have a tasting room, it'll be a good way for consumers to get to know the brand a little bit better. Today, we're found in about 20 liquor stores. Crown, Elite Beverage, some independents, and so you just got to get people out there and get people interacting with the brand and do as many events and tastings as possible.
So what's the reaction been to the products that you've released so far?
We've been really lucky. They've all been really, really positive. We've released some unique spirits. Some people do moonshines. We released a corn whiskey, which is slightly different. Moonshine traditionally has sugar put into it in the mash bill, and it's a sweet vodka is what I kind of like to say, and then so it's been really positive. There, it goes really well in tequila based cocktails or any cocktail that you want a sweeter spirit in. So a sour margarita, a spicy Bloody Mary, it goes well on those, and so that's positive. I drink actually that spirit quite a bit. And then our Double Down, our aged aged quarter whiskey and used bourbon, aged and used bourbon barrels. Been really positive. If you like scotch, you like single malts, it's going to be a unique one for you that you're really going to like. We've got a lot of positive feedback on both of those two spirits. And then we just released our bourbon, and when we did our tasting, we sold out at our tasting when we had it at Elite Beverage in Noblesville last week. And no one said anything bad about it. So we're thrilled. Reaction's been really positive.
So tell me a little bit about developing the company, you know, and starting it out. You know, I think that, honestly, companies like yours, you know, a distillery, it seems to me like it's some people's dream, right? So you kind of are living the dream and starting your own distillery. You know, it's like, you know, the popularity of craft beer, and it's like, oh my gosh, I'd love to start a brewery. You know, so I think distilling is kind of coming along that same path. Talk a little bit about your experiences in learning the business.
Yeah, so it's just like any business. It's really difficult to learn and grow a business. And so, you know, there were some, I don't want to say trip-ups, but there's always some hurdles, no matter when you start your own business. And so with that, you know, we started producing on a very small level in December on the weekends, nights and weekends, and just to kind of learn how to do it. And unfortunately, at a small level, you're never going to make any money, or you're never going to have a sustainable business. So it'd be just a hobby. The thing about distilling that's different than beer is you can't legally distill at home. So for us, unless you've done training, which we did, at a distillery, there's no way to independently learn.
So you can't just be practicing.
You can't, unfortunately. My brother, our head distiller, Julian, is a trained scientist, and so he's done distillations in labs, and we all did training sorts of distilleries. So that was the kind of the way we learned, if you will. And then from there, it was a crash course. It was, let's start this thing and see where it goes. Let's see if we can make a spirit. And then once we figured out, oh, man, we can actually make a pretty good spirit, our process was completely designed by scratch. We didn't have – a lot of distilleries have consultants come in, and they'll design the process for them and tell them how to use the equipment. We designed everything from scratch. Our whole process it was designed from scratch and is completely unique. We said, we like this about this process, this about this process, this about this equipment, and kind of mashed it all together to create our own. And from there, we scaled the company up and started producing a lot more. So it's come with its fair amount of challenges. Although it is a dream, and I love tasting whiskey and drinking whiskey, there's definitely a lot of headaches, too.
Well, now, of course, you still have a day job, right? So tell me about the team, you know, and, you know, your friends, your brother, and, you know, and how it all came together.
Yeah, so the team is made up of myself, David McIntyre, and Julian Jones. I come from a finance operations and sales background. David comes from a legal and sales background. And my brother comes from a scientific background. And so we all kind of lent well as a team and the development team. We absolutely have our lanes. Finance operations, kind of mine, as you know, a regulated business like this, it's really good to have a partner that has a JD. So he's on the JD, helps with operations, helps with sales as well. And then my brother on the production manager side, really fundamental in developing our process. And he's there doing the mashes and doing the distillations on a day-to-day basis.
What's the hope for the company? You know, you're an Indiana company. You're focusing on Indiana corn. Where do you want to go from here?
We want to be the first internationally known whiskey distiller based in the state of Indiana. We always want to pay homage to the state of Indiana and everything that we do, but we want to be known worldwide. We want to make it known. When you think Indiana and you think whiskey, you think West Fork Whiskey Company, and we want to make the state proud in doing that.
Do you think that it's going to happen? And how long is it going to take? I mean, that's a lofty goal, you know, for some guys, honestly, who haven't done this before, right? So, you know, is it realistic?
Oh, it's absolutely realistic, right? Apple was started in a garage, and so there's always great startup stories, and so you got to dream big. And so for us, that's our dream. We want to have our products distributed and sold worldwide, who knows if it's ever going to happen. If we end up just being a great distiller that sells products in Indiana, that'll be awesome too, and we'll love doing it because we love the spirit and we want to enjoy it with as many people as possible. So who knows, but we're gonna work hard to create the best product we can and do Stay Proud and trying to get there.
So you only do whiskey. What are some new products that you're going to be developing, things that are coming maybe down the road?
Yeah, so for us, I mentioned our bourbon just was released, and that was a wheated bourbon. Our next product that will be releasing in about 3 or 4 months will be a rye-based bourbon, so a little bit of that more depth and spiciness, if you will, from the rye content. And then we'll release at least one rye, probably two ryes, so you get a different types of rye whiskey, probably one that's 100% rye, and then one that's lighter on the rye and heavier on some sweet, so it'll be an interesting mix of that. That sweetness and the spiciness, and then single malts after that. And we want to do a bunch of specialty releases eventually once we get that core base of 5 to 7 products out there that kind of run the gambit. We'll probably never do a Canadian-style whiskey, which is a mix of grain-neutral spirits and straight whiskey. Probably not for us, but you never know. But we've got a lot of great whiskeys coming out, and we'll run the full gambit, and then we'll start doing some interesting finishing of our spirits and a lot of different types of barrels, a lot of different mash bills. So we're excited to see what the future brings.
So where can people actually find the product right now?
You can find the product in many Crown Liquor locations, Elite Beverage locations, Classic Spirits on the north side, a handful of Independence, Renaissance Hotel actually, and Carmel picked us up. We thank them for that. And request it. I mean, every time you go out and you meet a bartender, you're in the liquor store, I mean, request the spirit and they can pick it up. We're distributed through to RNDC. Yeah, everyone asks for it everywhere you go.
We've been talking with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey. For more information on the distillery and its products, go to westforkwhiskey.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our first show of the new year, and thanks also to our guests, promoter RJ Wall of Chef's Night Off, Kara Gunthorpe of Gunthorpe Farms in LaGrange, Indiana, and Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.